All right, let's head over to the Zoom line where we have Mr. Steve Bakken on the line with us. Of course, he's the Burleigh County Commissioner, the former mayor of Bismarck, but he's also the host of Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270, where he and myself do Wattage Wednesday on. We do it on Wednesday, right, Steve? Is that what day that we do it on? Wattage Wednesday? It's usually. Seems to go pretty well. But anyway, this week we have Jody Johnson joining us with Red Trail Energy. And this is a fascinating story. This is absolutely fascinating. It's the first one in the nation, correct, Jody? Is that right? First one in the nation to do some carbon capturing on site. Is that right?
We are the first fully operational commercial CCS facility in North Dakota. We're the first one that has been permitted under a Class 6 well under state primacy in the U.S. There is an ethanol plant down in an ADM plant that did have carbon capture and storage, but they don't use it for commercial purposes.
I see. Okay, but there is some first in the nation, so it is kind of exciting, basically, because it means that North Dakota is being a pioneer, a trailblazer. Red Trail Energy. First of all, Jody, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us. And what is Red Trail Energy? And, you know, as CEO, kind of give us an overview of, you know, who your customer is and what you're doing for the company.
Yeah, so Red Trail Energy, we're a corn-based ethanol production facility. We're located in Richardton, North Dakota. We produce about 65 million gallons of ethanol annually, ground just under 23 million bushels of corn. So we generate about 2.85 gallons of ethanol from every bushel of corn. We started production back in January of 2007. And since that time, we were originally constructed as a 50 million gallon ethanol production facility. So since that time, we have put in a lot of upgrades, you know, changes to operations to kind of get us up to that 65 million gallon production capacity. On top of that, we do have co-products that we produce. We produce dried distiller grains and modified distiller grains that we sell for animal feed, and then distiller's corn oil that goes as a feedstock for second generation biofuels.
Jody, Steve Bakken here, and you know, I want to go back and talk a little bit about some of the history, because the Red Trail Energy was an interesting story on where it came about, because we don't typically think of Western or Central Western North Dakota as being part of the Corn Belt. So I remember when the conversation was first coming to light that, hey, there's a bunch of local producers and a bunch of people that are interested in putting an ethanol plant in your neck of the woods. And people were questioning that, and people around the state were questioning that, but it's not in the Corn Belt. And you got to remember, because of our northern climate, and when this conversation started, you know, define a Corn Belt. Well, that's really changed. So talk a little bit about the impetus of Red Trail Energy, because I think that is just a fascinating story from an entrepreneurial perspective on where the thought process came from that, hey, we should have one out here.
Yeah, so the group that formed Red Trail Energy formed back in 2003, and their, you know, goal was to build an ethanol production facility. We are 100% investor owned, so they did go out and they gathered enough support that they needed to build it in this area. They somewhat chose this area due to, you know, the location next to the Burlington Northern Rail Line. Originally, we were constructed to be a coal-fired plant, and so they wanted to be close to, you know, where we could get lignite coal to fire the plant and keep it running. And yeah, there wasn't really any corn production in the area. You know, now about 55% of our corn purchases come from a 100-mile radius with, you know, from the facility. So we've really built up a good corn base here in our local region.
So the age-old location has a technicality known as technology, because if you can create enough technology, apparently you can have remote workplaces and corn growing in places that historically we don't grow in. So let's talk about the technology involved. with Red Trail Energy, whether it's from the carbon capture side or whether it's from the innovation that went into the agriculture side. My guess is that what you're dealing with is something that has a lot of innovation and a lot of technology, Jody.
Yes, for sure. I mean, the biggest one would be our carbon capture and storage project that we placed in service in 2022. And that, you know, just took a lot of collaboration with, you know, Red Trail Energy and the EERC, the Energy and Environmental Research Center, to really pull all of that information together and get the right equipment in place and, you know, make sure that we're, you know, have all of the information for the permit to get up to get our storage permit from the North Dakota Industrial Commission. And so that's like the biggest one. You know, we also have other technologies that we've placed into service here. Back in 2021, we installed a USP distillation unit so we can produce industrial grade alcohol that would meet the pharmaceutical monograph. And we've just another, you know, expansions, minor additions to the site to just become more efficient in what we do and how we produce. You know, corn oil extraction, that wasn't added until 2012. And that's been a great market to get into the, you know, renewable fuels market, selling distillers corn oil into there, you know, trying to think of other things that we've done to kind of make the, to kind of build us to where we're at and the production capacity to where we're at. You know, another one was, you know, switching from coal fire to natural gas. That was definitely a good upgrade for us, just because natural gas is a little more consistent, consistent fuel source to use than the coal was.
You know, Jody, the theme here, though, is Red Trail Energy has been at the cutting edge or in front of technology. So you guys have been very innovative when it comes to bringing new products online or it comes to new technology. You're very much ahead of the curve, both regionally and around the country. Where does that innovation come from? I mean, you know, there's that old adage that if you want something fixed or you want something invented, ask a farmer or a rancher, because they probably had to come up with something for their operation that they had to make work. Is that that philosophy that comes from your member ownership that, hey, we're going to go out and we're going to be on the cutting edge of things and we're going to try to innovate and do things a little differently and try to stay ahead of the curve, because that's what we do in the agrarian side of things in North Dakota?
Yeah, definitely. We have a 7-member board of directors that are very supportive. They really want us to innovate and to, you know, stay ahead of other ethanol production facilities and what can we do. So that support has been probably the biggest factor in where we are today. You know, along with that too, you know, our investor group, we hold annual investor meetings and, you know, we bring new ideas to them and to get their feedback on it and, you know, hear how much they enjoy hearing about these things and the work that we're doing here. I mean, that's always, you know, very, very good to have. You know, also our former CEO, Gerald Bachmeyer, like he has a vision and he had a passion for ethanol. And so he brought a lot to this and guided a lot of this change that we've been seeing over the years. And he just retired September of 2023. So I haven't been in this position for very long, but, you know, I think it's just bringing the right group of people together that can talk about these ideas and want to take the time to actually research these ideas and bring them you know, to life. You know, the carbon capture and storage project, you know, we started talking about that in 2016 and, you know, we didn't get our permit until 2021, started injecting until 2022. A lot of this just takes time and, you know, just to keep, you know, people focused on it and keep kind of moving forward with them takes a lot of time. Also, we have our marketing arm is RPMG. They're based out of Shakopee, Minnesota, and, you know, they market for multiple ethanol plants, and they have also just been a huge help with all of this and with, you know, helping research things, helping research the various markets that we can sell into, what type of innovation would be the best to get into the market, you know, and that. So we really just have a great group of people that have come together to make this plant as successful, sorry, as it is.
We're talking with Jody, the CEO of Red Trail Energy, and I want to talk about the innovation side when it came to carbon capture. Where did you guys first start having that discussion about, okay, this is on the horizon, there may be an opportunity here, and then tell us a little bit about the thought process of CO2 as a commodity and how that fits into the portfolio eventually.
Yes. So as I said, a lot of those discussions started in 2016. So we had a collaboration between Red Trail and the EERC out of the University of North Dakota. And we were really researching a way to differentiate ourselves from other conventional ethanol facilities. We wanted to gain access into the low carbon fuel markets and markets that we weren't able to gain access into with the current carbon intensity score of the ethanol that we were producing at that time. And so the EERC was already doing research into carbon capture, utilization, and storage. They were already looking at the geology. So it was just a really great fit to work with them and form this collaboration to bring the CCS project to life. You know, as I said, initially we were looking at the low carbon fuel markets, you know, California being the biggest one that we were trying to get into. You know, as the project evolved, as we started capturing CO2 and kind of renegotiating what we had and where we were going, I guess, with our ethanol markets, you know, we're still looking into California and, you know, the pathways into that. And we're still, you know, we have a pathway into Oregon for a CCS pathway for low carbon fuel standard, you know, but it was kind of discussions with eco engineers that was helping us model some of these other pathways that brought it to our attention and said, you know, along with low carbon fuel markets, you know, there are voluntary carbon markets that, you know, might be a good fit for your organization, you know, if you so choose to go that route. And so discussions with them started, and then we brought in our marketing partner, RPMG, and we all just kind of really took a few months to learn about voluntary carbon markets and, you know, gain all the understanding, all the information we could. And we just moved forward with Puro Earth as the voluntary carbon market that we decided on and moved forth to get registration into there for another avenue for selling our CO2 if it doesn't go into a low carbon fuel market with the ethanol molecule.
Voluntary carbon markets, is that what the phrase is?
Yes, it is.
Okay, I was writing that down. I have a question about geology. My understanding is that geology plays a very big part in carbon capture. And in order to be on site, to do on site carbon capture, you have to be on some rocks or some formations that allow for it. And that's correct, right? Am I following it so far? I've been told that by some experts, so I think that's pretty accurate. But how much did that play into the expediting and just the, whether it be the savings or whether it be, talk about that geology part, because I know that there was some carbon capture in the southern part of North Dakota with Denbury. Was there any collaboration with that, or was the geology different and the carbon capture different? So two-part question. One is geology, and two is whether there was any collaboration with the Denbury, who was doing a carbon capture. I believe with natural gas down in the southern part in Bowman. Is that natural gas or is it crude down there, Steve? Do you know? Anyway, Jody, you'd probably know better than me, so.
But there was no collaboration with Denbury. We started researching this project kind of all on our own. But you're right, the geology is kind of the biggest part of it. We are sitting in the perfect location for it. We have the Broom Creek Formation about 6,500 feet below us, and that's the saline formation that the CO2 is being injected into for permanent storage. And then they have, you know, the cap rock, the proper cap rock over top of that to make sure that it stays within that formation. There's actually another formation down there called the Inacharna, and that is, I believe, about 4,500 feet down there. So it's a little bit above the Broom Creek, but that's another saline formation that we could eject CO2 into as well. So we really are in the perfect location, and just owning all of the property that we have so that we keep the injection well, the monitoring well, the flow line are all just contained on our own property right next to the plant.
All right. So the next question I have, also, I get this pronunciation messed up all the time. Is it privacy or primacy? Primacy. Primacy, right? Primacy?
Primacy, yep.
Now, primacy is kind of like a superpower with the EPA where you can approve some in-state permits. And I think there's a couple. I know Louisiana just got awarded that at the beginning of the year. And is it Wyoming is another state that might have it, Jody? Do you explain that kind of that law, that superpower that North Dakota has?
So Wyoming is another state, sorry, that
does
have primacy. Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
So, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say Louisiana, we did an interview with Dr. Lauren Scott in January, right after they were awarded theirs. And then, so, you know, North Dakota's had it for a while. And, you know, after we kind of, you know, just kind of set the table a little bit on what the primacy law is, or like I say, that superpower that the state has, I wanted to ask you, how much did that facilitate to get where you're at? Because my understanding is that it really does eliminate a lot of federal red tape at the end of the day to advance some of these quote unquote science projects that have a lot of research into them. So that's kind of where I was going with the question. So that's I'm not sure if we're at the Charlie Rose table or the radio interview station yet, but anyway, so does that question make sense?
Yes, it does. It does make sense. Yeah. We're definitely thankful for the North Dakota Industrial Commission and the staff at the Department of Mineral Resources. They're the ones that just never gave up on receiving the Class 6 primacy from the EPA. And, you know, we wouldn't have been able to move as quickly forward as we could without that. You know, we, the application that we put in for our Class 6 well, once we got it into the North Dakota Industrial Commission, it took them under 6 months to review that application and turn around and approve it to us. And I mean, that would have never happened with the EPA. So that played a major role in us being able to, once we decided on the project and had everything in place, just move forward with the project, start drilling our wells and ordering equipment so that we could start capturing CO2.
Jody Johnson, the CEO of Red Trail Energy. Steve Bakken, also on the program as the co-host of this podcast and Wattage Wednesday episode on Super Talk 1270, Town Square's Talk of the Town. So we were doing kind of a multi-purpose today, Steve. Look at us. Hey, we're being resourceful. I think we're going to get carbon credits for how many uses we're going to get out of this interview. Which leads me to my next question, actually, which is enhanced oil recovery. Now, there's a secondary market for some of this carbon capture as well. I know there's some stipulations, whether there's a permanent storage or 7 years, 8 years, 15 years. It depends on which regulation I'm looking at and which zone and which day of the week it is. So I'm not up to date, and I apologize, folks. You'll have to do the devil in the detail work yourself. But the basic question is the secondary market, whether there's enhanced oil or, you know, malt beer, carbonated beverages, that type. Can you start bringing in, you know, other ethanol plants for storage type of a thing? Do you have a secondary market at all, Jody?
We've had discussions on enhanced oil recovery. You know, we've had discussions from for beverage grade, CO2, I had a phone call from a greenhouse that was, growing marijuana in a different state and wanted to know if they could get some CO2 for their growing process. So we've had a lot of interest in our carbon capture system. And so that is something that we could do if we chose to, instead of, permanently storing the CO2, it's something that we could go out and sell, into a different market. It's not in our business plan at this time to look at that, in order to get some of the 45Q tax credits, in order to be able to qualify for some of the low carbon fuel standards, we do need to permanently store that CO2 for that purpose.
Yeah. Well, Steve, do you think the North Dakota tourism or North Dakota commerce would promote the good life if Red Trail started selling CO2 to some pot farmer in Oregon?
That's an interesting question, but you think about the other industrial uses for CO2, and I always view it as a commodity. And from a business plan perspective, Jody, how cognizant of you are you of the fact that you have to measure the investment for utilizing CO2 as a commodity? Because a simple example, I think it's about $150 a liter for medical purposes. If you think about somebody having a surgery, it's CO2. They don't put oxygen into your body if you're going to have a knee surgery or a knee replacement to give the physician, the surgeon, operating space in there. It's CO2. So there's a lot of different applications for CO2 as a commodity. When you're balancing out the carbon credits from a business perspective versus the investment it takes to be able to produce some of those products as a commodity, walk us through that process, that thought process a little bit, because that's got to be a hard decision. Because again, you're a for-profit business in the private sector, trying to manage the business model that's going to have a return for your investors, who in your case are your producers.
Yeah, there was a lot of, discussions around those subjects on, how do we best utilize the CO2. We did always just kind of come back to the low carbon fuel markets, just focusing more on lowering our carbon intensity of the ethanol that we produce, and just expanding those markets instead of going out into a different market to sell the CO2. So that was really kind of our main focus from the start. I mean, we've entertained, discussions with other entities and stuff, but, focusing more on getting that 45Q tax credit so that our investors are able to utilize that. And then focusing on the low carbon fuel markets in our main process.
Jody Johnson, Red Trail Energy, Richardton, North Dakota. And I just wanted to change gears for just a second. Appreciate the time. Pioneer in carbon capture at the end of the day. I wanted to ask you about that. Wanted to ask you about being a woman in the industry. We just, every March on the Crude Life, we do Women's History Month. And so every day in the month of March, we feature a different woman, because we believe if you're working in the oil and gas or energy industry and you're a woman, you're now you're a pioneer. You're part of that next level. So I did want to ask you about that a little bit too. But aviation fuel, there was a new guidance released, I want to say yesterday or the day before, the GREET model, and it's with sustainable aviation fuel. Are you involved with that? Who is your end customer when it comes to ethanol and that type of thing? Because it seems like ethanol is very much going the way of aviation and a lot of that direction.
Yes, it definitely is. I think that's probably going to be a good future for ethanol, is to get into the sustainable aviation fuel market. From my understanding, that's still some very expensive technology to be able to build those plants and, create SAF from ethanol. But I think that would be a good market that could open up, The problem kind of with a lot of, the ethanol plants is, we have E85 and we have E10, and a lot of places don't have that E15 higher blend. And so we are kind of, for a fuel market, we're kind of to the point where, the ethanol plants are able to meet the need for it, and there isn't much room for us to expand unless we do go up to higher fuel blends and maybe have a little room for expansion there. So yeah, I do believe sustainable aviation fuel will be a good future for ethanol.
I did have one quick follow-up, Steve, before you jump in here. And is there, Jody? I don't know if you're even this is something you can answer or not, but I know there's 45Q credits, and that has to do with carbon capture. And then there's 40B SAF credits that have to do with sustainable aviation fuel. Does it get complicated when it comes to these all these different programs and because aren't they all kind of time-based and they've got all these different milestones and it would seem like you would have to really do a lot of balancing with that, it would seem.
Yes, there is, yes, a lot of work that goes into these tax credits and gathering all the information that you need to be able to claim the tax credits, the verifications you have to go through for claiming those. The 45Z is coming out. That's going to be a tax credit. I think it's only going to be available for 3 years starting in 2025, but they don't really have much guidance out on it yet. We're getting very close to when you can start to claim that tax credit. So waiting on the IRS and waiting for some of that guidance has definitely been a little stressful and kind of make planning your budget a little difficult.
I didn't realize that the shock and awe had made it to the ethanol industry because that's always kind of like we've always said that in the media that they always release like these grants like a week before they're due. So it's like shock and awe to quick get okay, how are we going to get our stuff together here quick? Because we got about 3 days to prepare and stuff like that. But anyway, Steve, I know you had a question. Go ahead.
Well, I did. And, the aviation side of that is very, very interesting to me because I take a look at what Boeing was trying to play with electric batteries and that didn't work and the weight involved. But the fuel side with aviation fuel, I think has a lot of promise and a great piece for our ethanol industry here in North Dakota. I want to go back because you mentioned the E85 and the E10s and the different blends that are out there and the different states that allow different things, navigating a marketplace where there's not really a blanket standard has got to be interesting. I know I've been driving flex fuel vehicles off and on since 2007. I think that they have a place if I'm on the interstate doing 80, I'm probably not going to go down that route. If I'm driving in town, I don't lose mileage and there's a great benefit. I go to other states and I see some of these other different blends. Like if I'm over in Minnesota, they have an 88 octane blend, and I've found that's very fuel efficient. Explain to the listeners a little bit the variations because there's so much stuff out in the marketplace, and I think it gets confusing to the consumers unless you're really paying attention to a lot of this. As a producer, how do you manage that and then make sure that what the consumer needs is out there?
We're doing a lot of work with the North Dakota Ethanol Producers Association, and the North Dakota Ethanol Council. We work closely with the North Dakota Corn Growers Association on, trying to get some of those higher blends, that E15, to be a year-round blend here in North Dakota. So a lot of it is just kind of the education on the blends and what the benefit would be to, I guess, our industry to be able to have those more options than what we're currently seeing right now.
So, Jody, are you seeing that for a consumer perspective, and this is just my personal research and me utilizing this, different blends have different applications. Is that what you're seeing in the industry as well?
I'm sorry, I guess I didn't follow your question.
So, when as an industry, We see different blends out there. And from a consumer perspective, what I see in my own personal use is there's different applications for different uses. How I'm using that ethanol product in my vehicle has a bearing on how I use it and when I buy it. So for me, a lot of the consumer side is, do you have the different options available for, am I driving on the highway? Am I driving in town? Am I pulling a trailer? For those different applications and when I need it. So whether it's blender pumps or it's coming from the plants, how difficult is it to provide those different products and a varied product line to consumers so that they can be extremely comfortable with the integration of the product? So, is it this week you guys are cranking out E15, next week you're cranking out E10? How does that split out from a manufacturer perspective?
Oh, okay. Now I understand. Yeah. So from a manufacturing perspective, we just produce the ethanol and then it gets sent to the fuel companies that then blend it and make the E10 or the E85. So that's kind of on their decision making on.
Goes through a refiner's process just like regular oil does. And I don't think people quite understand that. They think that that ethanol plant they see alongside the interstate, well, that's producing what I go to the pump and get. And that's not the process. You're providing the product for that blending. It still goes through the refiner's process, correct?
That is correct. Yep. And then it's from there they set up what their blends are going to be. If it's going to be an E85, E10, which is the most common blend out there.
Jody Johnson, Red Trail Energy, ethanol plant out in Richardton, North Dakota. I was just pulling up your website and is this a new logo? How long have you had this logo?
We got that logo. It's been a little over a year. Something.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I was I when it when I came to the website, I thought, "Boy, this doesn't remind me of what I remember the logo being." So I thought I'd mention, folks, check it out, redtrailenergy.com, new logo, very modern looking for sure. And Red Trail Energy. So we're not ethanol, we're energy. And that seems to be the trend now, where whether you're oil, whether you're gas, whether you're coal, whether you're solar, whether you're wind, hydro, you're now energy. And I personally, I like that. I think it's much easier, much cleaner that way. Now, in California, I find it interesting because there's like 57 different blends of gasoline and all kinds of different things. That's why I think it's good just to go with straight energy. But I wanted to ask you about being a woman in energy, or either a woman in, as a CEO, even. I suppose it could be even a pioneer from that standpoint. How's that going for you? What are you learning? What are you, bringing to this role? I mean, I personally think a woman's voice is needed in energy because women have an intuition that I believe energy that is needed right now. I think STEM is great. I think science is great. I think innovation is great, but I also think you need some intuition in there too. Talk to me about being a female in the energy industry.
Yeah, so I'm very blessed that the board of directors appointed me to this position. So I was the chief financial officer with Red Trail Energy for 10 years prior to our CEO then announcing that he was going to retire, and the board of directors appointed me to this position. And it is a very different experience than being a CFO. I mean, the CEO role is a lot more big picture and a lot more looking into the future and what direction can we go. A little less focused on the numbers that I was a little more comfortable focusing on, but it's been a really great experience for me. I'm just celebrated my 1 year anniversary as CEO back in April, and yeah, there's a really great group of women in this industry. So when I go to the National Ethanol Conference, there's a women's meeting group that just has a really Sorry, not to be miss you say it again, but a really great group of women that I can turn to and ask for guidance on, and you know, kind of ask them for assistance if I need it. You know, and everybody in the industry is really great. It's a really close group of individuals, and I mean, I can turn to any other CEO that I want. So it's been a very good experience. But a pretty big learning curve for me.
Well, when it comes to this carbon capture, what is the number one thing that you think people should know out there? There's a lot of discussion, a lot of chatter, a lot of information, a lot of misinformation, and a lot of science and a lot of realities. What's your takeaway from either when you started, what you've learned from it, what your daily reality is being someone involved with carbon capture? What's kind of your message, I guess, to those people who might have questions about any sort of carbon management?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first concern that, you know, individuals always bring up is the safety, you know, the projects. And I think we need to really get the word out that these projects are safe. I mean, ours is designed with multiple safety precautions in place, you know, automatic shutoffs if we should lose communication with the wellhead, you know, just things like that. So they're designed to be safe. And I think a lot of individuals, yeah, need to just ask more questions if they have questions about that. We did a lot of public outreach projects before we even moved forward with the project to just kind of get the community involved and the community comfortable, you know, with the project. You know, I've also heard some criticism of, you know, about selling carbon, and you know, some of those markets are still being defined, and I think we're going to see, you know, a lot more expansion for the carbon markets and what comes out there. And I know that there's a lot of concerns, you know, about that. So I think people just need to really do their due diligence and research when they're looking into these carbon markets to make sure that they are secure, that they're, you know, really legitimate, I guess, would be the only term I can think of for that.
I'm Steve Bach along with Jason Spies. I'm Steve Bach along with Jason Spies. We're talking with Jody Johnson, CEO of Red Trail Energy in Richardton, North Dakota. Ethanol plant, member owned, producer owned. I guess, Jody, do you consider yourself a cooperative at that point with the way your membership is structured?
No, we are just 100% investor owned. We're a publicly reported company, so we report to the Securities and Exchange Commission. So I kind of put us in that category more.
Well, I you're publicly to ask you, owned. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Jason, they're public, but it's an interesting model though. And it's kind of a North Dakota innovative model on taking the best of both worlds and navigating in an interesting space. So what's the future look like, Jody, when you're looking big picture? Cause now you're in that CEO hat and you mentioned the big picture, a little different thought process. And we've talked about some of the innovation and being on the front edge of things and aviation fuel. And we're seeing other fuel sources mentioned like hydrogen. What's the role? What's the place of ethanol in terms of the producer and in the marketplace down the road? What are you focusing in on? Because a lot of discussion on the CO2 and the sequestration, and is it a commodity? But you're competing out in the market space with traditional energy sources, oil and gas and coal, and hydrogen is coming. What's the future look like if you're putting that hat on as a CEO?
I think the future for Red Trail Energy is just for us to keep focusing on how we can kind of keep lowering our carbon intensity score. You know, if we want to go into the sustainable aviation fuel industry, you know, we need to make sure that we have a carbon intensity score low enough to be a good fuel feedstock for SAF. And so I think that's going to be the big picture and the focus for us is what other innovative things can we do here to just continue lowering that score. And I mean, combined heat and power is kind of the first project that we're going to look into. We're doing some engineering work right now, some research into that, and how can we integrate that into our system where we are actually producing our own electricity to run and would be off the electrical grid, and just kind of run efficiently that way. And then just keep looking for, you know, more ways to just keep making our CI score as low as possible.
Jody Johnson, Red Trail Energy. Folks, check it out, redtrailenergy.com. They have a new logo, almost a year old. Look at, I mean, they must have, you know, really rolled out the red carpet for you, Jody. New logo and everything. You coming into position. And all right, Jody, before we go, I do want to ask you about, I know you've got some exciting news. I don't know if you can release it yet, but let's find out if you have any final thoughts or anything in closing.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to, you know, thank our producers and thank our investors for all their continued support over the years.